And joining me now in the studio, I have Snyderville Basin Planning Commissioner Chuck Klingenstein. Good morning, Chuck.
Good morning.
So you were one of the planning commissioners who wanted to look at option two of the Commons at New Park plan. How come?
Well, there are actually about six options that we asked the developer to go back and take a look at. And the reason I liked two personally is I'm after reading the design guidelines and architectural stuff and the development agreement, you know, really Main Street is an important street and urban design and town center principles. And I feel like I'd like to understand, you know, a zero lot line, sort of a brownstone apartment, townhouse type feel along the street, and then see what could be done on the backside facing the plaza that would allow for a nice integration of the project from both sides.
So option number two basically puts Main Street adjacent to the plaza and then pushes the building farther back.
Well, it pushes the building, actually, depending on where, what front or back. Front, it pushes it closer to the existing center drive. If you read the design guidelines that are a part of the development agreement, it says a zero lot line is required and it is, allows residential on the main floor.
Yeah, but Matt Crandall, the applicant, said that's certainly an option that they strongly oppose. He said a hammerhead building entry in the plan would take away space from the plaza. The road would have to be elevated over event goers on the other side. So we've talked about some real safety hazards.
Well, I don't know. I'm asking, and had the support of the commission, let's take a look at it in more detail. A lot of what the architect did was take a look at these six ideas and then come up with the objections and constraints from a very somewhat superficial level. And, you know, I certainly saw problems with a lot of the options that they analyzed and that I agreed with. But option two, I thought merited a little more investigation, and the commission felt the same. You know, I wasn't alone on it. And we just want a little deeper investigation. If it's, as I said on the record, if I'm out in the night, the staff will tell me, Chuck, you're out in the night, and it's not a good idea.
Yeah. Joel Fine suggested we just take out a unit. Would that help?
Yeah, it might actually. If we pull the entire project to the main street, and I asked for investigation about the street right-of-way and street dedication, so you get flexibility pulling it closer to the street. And Joel's idea was there is an attainable unit that's a part of this that wasn't required because New Park already built its apartment complex to meet its affordable housing requirement. The developer had volunteered to put this in, thinking it would be a good community idea. But we said, let's take a look at that concept and see if that gives us the additional flexibility to eliminate the hammerhead issue.
So are we doing this to preserve the sun in the plaza and to preserve the view in New Park Hotel?
They've actually done a whole bunch of shadow studies, and the time when the sun's the worst is the time when nobody's going to be out there sitting listening to music. So I don't think it's the sun issue necessarily. It's honoring a lot of the town design principles that you just spoke about that Thomas alluded to. I haven't considered the hotel views because our goal is to honor the original intent of the development agreement and all the work that went into it.
So how the debate about whether this complies with the New Park development agreement or not, is this ever going to be put to bed here?
No, I mean, we're going to put it to bed as a planning commission because that's our job to sort through these things. As I mentioned, and I think Jamie kept saying, Chuck said, the development agreement, as hard as we work on them, there's always ambiguities, inconsistencies, because they're sometimes just huge documents. And this one, by I think it's well over 200 pages. And so you can pick a page, you can pick a sentence, you pick a paragraph and, you know, pick it apart. And I think Jamie really hit it. The legislature has basically said if there's a tie, the tie goes to the developer. In my case, and I believe the commission's case, we're heading in the direction of we're looking at it holistically and trying to come up with a fair compromise to allow the project move forward.
So if this doesn't block the sun from the plaza where a lot of people gather. And if it doesn't matter what the hotel views are, then why are Chris Eggleton and Jim Doyle so against this?
You know, we've heard a lot of hearsay or public clamor, you know, which is stuff said on the microphone to us in a public hearing. And I don't know what's the truth. I don't even want to get bogged down in those things. I just look at the facts of the case, the development agreement, and I believe the commission has worked hard to really understand that document. That is the guiding document.
All right. So when do you think this will come back? Next month or at the January meeting?
I would guess the January meeting, given the amount of work that the applicant is going to need to do with his team, and then to allow adequate time for public noticing, and just as importantly, give our staff time to really understand and work with the applicant.
The Peter Caroon mixed-use project along Rasmussen Road, again, 102 units, 40 of them affordable, 8,200 square feet of commercial. The consensus of the Planning Commission apparently is that you like it, but can it pass provision 2.3 in the general plan? That basically that the Planning Commission pointed out is the that says that you won't create any new entitlements unless there's a compelling countervailing interest.
That is correct. And the reason we're entertaining it, and I believe towards the end of the discussion we were heading in the direction of it could be achieved, because our county council said strategically a part of our major efforts is affordable workforce housing, and we concur and honor that commitment. And we're working hard with Mr. Caroon and his team to make something work in this location. But, what is the magic number? And, you know, we may actually have an opportunity to get more workforce housing out of this type of a proposal, as opposed to we have some conceptual neighborhood mixed-use zones that are in the pipeline, but we have a lot of work to do on before they actually become legal, you know, zoning. We may actually not get as much out of those types of neighborhood mixed use as opposed to what's being proposed. So we're kind of excited with the concept. We get an easement along the river for a future trail. He and our staff have to work hard on some significant issues. Like one of the things we brought up is we want a commitment to a bus line through Rasmussen. It doesn't make sense to be building affordable housing, workforce housing, if we don't have a transit system to serve it. So we asked everybody to go back and get a commitment that we're going to have a transportation system in that corridor for future people living there. And there were some other issues also.
Well, so I guess if you do think that this is compelling and countervailing, then the question is how badly do we need affordable housing? And I'm guessing, do you even have any direction on that from the county council or the latest needs assessment?
Oh, the county council has been very clear that this is a part of their strategic effort and mission for the next year and probably, quite frankly, as far as we can see into the future. The price of dirt is not going down in this area. We feel that we want to honor that. We have a housing needs assessment draft that has not been approved or adopted. It's been morphing, I believe, since, the first one was probably 5 months ago, and there's been three iterations since then. I've seen most of them. And it keeps changing, and until that's formally adopted, it's hard to really say we have a needs assessment, though we all know there's a need. And then the other issue is, what's in the pipeline? We know we've got a whole bunch built. We know we've approved a bunch out there. But what's in the pipeline? Because, we just don't know. So we did ask for that information.
All right. So that'll come back as some kind of report then from?
We certainly hope so, because we think it's important we know about all the what the big picture is, so we know where it is, what it is, and plan accordingly.
On the work session for Woodward Gargosa, you looked at several issues. First, about the location of the main building. The consensus favors the site near Kilby Road. Basically, that's where the property is already disturbed. Only Planning Commissioner B. Peck, who was absent, has favored putting the building up into the hillside. You said you wanted to look up at breaking up the mass. Doesn't look like you got any interest there from other planning commissions. And would it even work?
You know, from an operational standpoint, I fully get why they want to have it in one long linear building. And linear is an incorrect. They're breaking up the mass and they're articulating the architecture and the, you know, materials and all that. My concern is coming off of Parleys and dropping down in the basin, I'd rather see three buildings integrated in the landscape as opposed to one big one. And it's a big building, and I think it's roughly 50,000 square feet, which is the footprint. And then you add in the volumetrics at its highest point, 45 feet tall. That's not the entire building. It steps down. But to me, that's a very urban-type building. And I guess, you know, if I were to fit that into the town center at Kimball Junction, like, say, the Field House, then you have the town, it blends in. It's context sensitive would be the fancy planning term. I could even see buildings at Quarry Junction below Pinebrook and Jeremy. We have a lot of buildings there. And one of the commissioners brought that up and said, what's the difference? And I said, we have buildings, there have context. And other commissioners felt strongly, and you know, and I'm really proud of the discussion we had on it. It's great serving with new people with new views, and they really felt strongly. This could become an iconic statement that we're coming into Park City in the Snyderville Basin, and you are entering a recreation resort area, and welcome.
But you don't believe that?
I think we can still say welcome. I just felt like breaking it up and, you know, into three buildings as opposed to one large building. And I'm happy to sit back and, you know, I'm happy that we had the discussion.
Yeah. The parking capacity, the applicant's figures show that at saturation, they'll have 18 extra stalls. Is that enough?
Well, I asked more in the line of, what if? What if they are incredibly successful and on their peak days, that 18 spaces of flex space suddenly disappear? What happens? Because on a conditional use permit, and this is a conditional use permit, they are basically vested. Once we approved this, we can't go backwards. So I'd rather try to consider, what if you have a parking saturation? What is the plan to deal with it? As opposed to, you know, everybody circling the area trying to find a parking place, parking on the street because they get frustrated. It's a no parking place, you know, tow trucks. I just assume have them have an idea how they're going to handle it. So we all go forward knowing.
So with the exception of Summit Park, this Gargoza Resort was probably one of the first developments there in that area. And when you think back, I mean, you know, today when we think about a ski area, you think about a big old day lodge. So why would this be any different in terms of approval? I mean, they're 50 years late on building the day lodge.
Well, it is kind of interesting. This has a long history, but the original spa approval was for a building that was, I'm rough on this one, roughly 4,600 square feet. That was the original spa approval. Since that time, the whole concept has morphed. Powder Corp, who's been great to work with and has really provided great information, I must compliment them on that, they acquired something called Woodward Sports Camps. That's a whole different model. And I like the model because the model is saying we're going to take kids who want to do fun activities on snow and bikes and all that. But we're going to teach them the foundations of how to go about it so you don't go off a half pipe or a jump or whatever and you've never done it before. We're going to use the building block model. But that's what changed the whole concept out there. They got, you know, they went to the council, they got a special exception permit for the height. That's what drove the size of the building. And our community development director said this was allowed under the current spa.
Okay. I wanted to ask you about affordable housing. Planner Ray Milliner's calculation of the required unit equivalent seems to be twice the number from the applicant. So what's your take?
My take is I don't have the time to really dig into this enough. I said staff, and I believe the commission largely said, same. We really want you to take a look at the facts. We really rely on you to dig into this. The applicant did what they chose to do, which is they hired an independent third-party contractor that is on an approved list from the county. They did an analysis based on numbers from all of their existing camps and some other similar uses, and that's what the number they came up with. Our affordable housing calculations don't have categories that meet Woodward and that type of a use. That's why when the calculation was done, it was in general. This is, their calculations are very specific. So okay. We're going to let the staff sort it.
All right, Chuck, thanks.
Good to see you. Thank you.
That's Denver Basin Planning Commissioner Chuck Klingenstein. It's the local news hour here on KPCW. The Park City Council meeting tomorrow and work session starting at 3 o'clock in the City Council chambers of the Marsac building. In the studio with a rundown of the agenda, I have City Manager Diane Foster along with Transportation Planning Manager Alfred Knotts. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's see. Earlier this year, Diane, City Council members established arts and culture as well as affordability and diverse community participation as new top priorities. At 3:15, you've got a half-hour discussion on arts and culture and then an hour's discussion on social equity. So what's this about?
So these are two topics, and one of the things that Council asked is for us to bring all these items back throughout the year. So on the arts and culture, they made this a priority in February, a top priority, and not really knowing at the time that we would be able to come to agreement with Sundance and Kimball and have the future arts and culture district in our future. So what this is about is this priority is actually talking about the whole of arts and culture, not just what we hope to build, an arts and culture district that we hope to build. So this is also talking about the master plan that the Park City Summit County Arts Council is leading, as well as things like our public art advisory board and the 1% for public art that we do in our capital projects.
So if the council's also asking whether or not these issues should be elevated to critical status or remain as a top priority. So what changes would take place if they do become critical priorities?
Yeah, this is an interesting debate because when you think about the critical priorities, I am so encouraged that so many people in the community are aware that for the city, transportation, housing, and energy are our critical priorities. Those were established in December 2014, and we've really gotten traction on them. One of the things that happens in the budgeting process, a critical priority gets weighted higher than a top priority. However, it's important to note that we still have other very important services, what we call essential services, such as community policing, which it's also important to fund. So these are just areas where council wants extra focus. The question for council, one of the questions is going to be, first and foremost, do you want to talk about this now or do you want to talk about it during the retreat? I think from a staff perspective, we'd like them, either way that they do it, we want them to look at all the priorities at once and not just look at them as individual ones, take more of a market basket approach. And so one of the theories could be that, well, we've focused on these things for a few years, we've got good plans in place, and we're not starting to move forward. We have moved aggressively forward on all of our goals, and we have projects in process. So on one hand, I think my particular perspective is let's not take our eye off the ball on those critical priorities. That being said, council can absolutely say, okay, keep going on those other ones, and we're going to maybe demote some and then elevate others, or maybe just have four critical priorities.
Yeah. So with regard to social equity, I mean, what's this about?
What this is about is City Council has had a number of discussions over the past few years. In fact, Mayor Jack Thomas, I think, presided over the first bilingual City Council meeting I believe that we ever held, which was a study session on Latino issues. And the mayor has been very involved, as well as Council Member Nan Worrell. On this issue, there are questions around affordability. And those are, you know, lots of folks in town, it's not, you know, while Park City is on average wealthier than most of Utah, when you think about what our middle class and lower income earners in our town are, we have a lot of those in the community. So looking at issues of affordability, of Latino issues, you know, you look at representation in the community, a third of our population roughly is Latino, and yet a third of our council is not Latino. And so do we have representation on our boards and commissions, and can we make better connections? And there's been a staff committee along with Councilmember Nan Worrell that's been working for about the past 2 months on this issue. And what they've done is they've gone ahead and said, what are the values around this? And their values of things like connection and treating people equally.
Well, when we have reached out to the Latino community, we can never get anyone to talk to us about the challenges they're facing because they don't feel safe. So what's the council going to do to help them feel more secure within our community?
Well, I think that's one of the opportunities is if you, you know, one of the things that City Council did earlier this year, they do coffee with council. They went and did that at Aspen Villas, which is one of the areas that has rental property that is a little bit more affordable. They went and had they actually did s'mores and met initially. A lot of the kids came out, and then once after a little while, a lot of the parents came out and sat down. And a lot of times, if you don't know somebody, you don't necessarily trust them. And if someone has undocumented status as a city, our city council has very much said that's not our issue. Our issue is making sure we get everybody involved. It's a super interesting discussion, and I really appreciate. I was just looking for the values that they're talking about. They're basically around affordability, connection, enhanced communication, issue awareness, and reflecting community diversity. And if you think about all of those are values that we hold as a community. And so having a priority of social equity and doing anything from making sure in staff reports we're aware of how different projects might affect different people in the community of all races, as well as affordability issues around that.
Okay, let's turn to you, Alfred, at 4:45, a critical priority update on transportation. There are about 14 projects currently in progress. I don't know that we have time to go through all of them, but let's start with the Mountain to Valley. What kind of feedback are you getting on this? And this, again, is the 224 improvements?
Yes, we're getting good feedback on kind of just pushing forward our objectives on giving priority to transit. Now, there are questions about, you know, why are we adding more pavement, things like that, or why are we not looking off the current 224 alignment? And those are good questions, and those are things we want to be able to answer in the environmental analysis, and that would be the next step of the project. But we also have gotten questions about where are the stops, where are things like that, where are going to be the future destinations, and that's really what the project is intended to flesh out. So when we do look at adding more pavement, back to kind of those questions, we're looking to actually add that pavement if there is, or repurpose the right-of-way for transit priority. When we do look at adding capacity through the system, we're looking at adding that capacity through strictly through transit and other alternative modes, not necessarily for the private automobile. So there is an existing footprint out there, and there's the ability to kind of repurpose that right-of-way, not only for the existing issues within the corridor, but also within the future issues. So they will look at a forecasting for the planning horizon is 2040. That is consistent with the UDOT statewide plan also. This is a UDOT facility. So we also need to look at balancing the needs too, because UDOT is, you know, they have other objectives to carry freight and goods and services and then also private automobiles. So how we can make that a true multimodal corridor.
Yeah. So in terms of alternative one, center running, alignment two, side running both sides of 224, or alignment three, side running on the west side of 224, do we have a favorite?
We do not. I mean, that's what this process is for, is to really get the feedback from the community. And there's multiple goals and objectives of the project. You know, there's environmental objectives, there's economic objectives, there's social objectives, and then there's future objectives also, and there's safety objectives too. So we do not right now. That's really part of the process. We don't want to come out predisposed to any type of alternative. It's really based on the technical analysis that we used to begin with, which we do a tier one screening, which is very qualitative, and it looks at what the potential impacts could be, what the potential benefits could be, and then we weed those out too, and they get down to the tier two where we can do more of a quantitative analysis. And we also looked at various modes also, similar to 248 when we looked at the rail trail, There's things that you actually go through and then you just document. So when it comes up, you know, do we look at monorail? Do we look at Hyperloop? Do we look at aerial technologies? We've looked at all those modes and we kind of weeded it down to light rail transit and bus rapid transit.
Yeah. Now, do you preclude by going with one of these alternatives? Do you preclude the future of light rail or something like that?
No, we do not. You know, what we like to explain to the community and what you really try to achieve through this initial phase and what the mode selected is really trying to get that dedicated right away. That's the hardest thing to do. And I think we can see that on 248. And it's really getting that separated right away. And what mode operates there in the future could be dictated by the future land uses. So maybe light rail, or say that there's the successful Olympic bid, should that happen, that could change the dynamic of what mode operates in that corridor. But it's really just trying to get that dedicated right away.
Yeah. Right now it looks like you only get bus or light rail. You don't get both.
Correct. So in the future, if we do go with the bus rapid transit at the mode, which we do have the rolling stock for, and we do have the technology, it's a proven technology in this environment, is that we could transition in the future over to different technologies such as light rail transit when it would make use or make sense of certain build-outs, say Canyon's build-out, more development around Kimball. And just having that nodal development.
Okay. A park and ride at US 40 and 248. Now, this is in addition to the existing Richardson Flat park and ride lot. Why would we build a second one? We're not even using the first one.
That was a question a preemptive strike I brought up yesterday at the chamber meeting also, and that's a good question. What we would weave into this scope of work is new park and ride on that parcel, but also have the engineering firm develop alternatives about how to best access the Richardson Flat lot also. So that would be part of this scope of work also. So at a point when we would get maybe a 30% design of what the US 40 portion of it looks like, and then we would have access improvements to 248, and then we prioritize, do we go forward with the Richardson Flat access, or do we go forward with the US 40 park and ride in itself, or do we run these concurrently? So this is really a fact-finding mission.
So where would this new park and ride be?
There's a parcel and there's a map in there. It's along the frontage road. I know it's probably hard to locate on that map, but there's a frontage parcel there that's UDOT parcel between US 40 and the frontage road on the east side of US 40 and on the north side of 248. So it's an opportunity where it's in the public domain. We've talked to UDOT and they've been open to us using that. They have no immediate use for that. It would be conditioned if we did build something there that it would have to be reclaimed by UDOT, and we would work through that process. But in the foreseeable future, there's no use for that parcel. And it does provide different access. If we can get access more directly from 248 on that parcel, then that would be a benefit also, coming maybe from the northbound, and we would lay all that out through this, what the pros and the cons are. So.
All right, but we don't have any in-town park and ride lots.
No, we don't have anything proposed right now. We're looking at kind of the intercept objective, and we're going to stick to that. I think that's what our solution really is in the long term as well. And that's really what these projects are laid out to do. And this information to the council and to the public is that we're moving forward on these longer-term capital projects. We've implemented – we went through yesterday a list of 42 things that we've implemented over the last year with our Joint Transit Advisory Board. And those have all been kind of service improvements, technological improvements, transit improvements, other outreach improvements and strategies. And now we're really getting down to the long-term objectives of these capital projects that need to support those services. So these are long-term projects. 248 is going to be a long-term project, 224. If we don't start now, these projects won't be done for another 5 to 7 years, and we want to get into this cycle of delivering a big capital project on a cyclical basis.
Okay, and then
we do have one park and ride lot in the city, and that is currently and for the next probably couple of years, we'll have a lot for Main Street employees who work in the evening, the homestake lot from 4 p.m. to 4 a.m.
But that goes away.
That's
temporary.
One.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. The 248 pedestrian safety improvement project, we're talking about some underground or overground at the seminary?
That is
crossing?
Correct. That is correct.
All right. So why would we use tax dollars for this? I mean, if we want to get why isn't the LDS church stepping up here?
We've talked to the church, and they're open to donating land. We've talked to the school district also. This is really our proactiveness in addressing an existing condition issue. What it will do is it provides us an opportunity to go to federal sources and state sources such as Safe Routes to School programs, active transportation programs. And again, that's kind of why you see a plan in there for active transportation. UDOT has said the other day they've gotten a lot of requests across the state about having bike lanes or bike trails. And they've essentially said at a policy level they won't entertain those requests unless these plans and improvements are in an adopted plan. So we're kind of running these concurrently, but we would get an estimate and a feasibility analysis of what it would cost and what the impacts would be, and then we could go to the state and federal sources also. So that's not atypical to front load a project with some local dollars.
Well, I would recommend that people go and have a look at this report because it's pretty significant. And real quick, the Deer Valley Drive bicycle and pedestrian improvements, is there really any room?
That's what we would evaluate. Right now there's some what's known as kind of the deer trails that are on the side that demonstrate that people are using it. And again, it kind of goes back to all these things are tied together in this report, and I know it's kind of hard to tie them all together, but it comes back to a complete streets policy that we're looking at and that active transportation plan as well, is to really provide facilities on these corridors, safe facilities for all modes and all users. So we've seen more and more put bicyclists along there, road bicyclists, even commuter bicyclists. I know we expect everybody to use the Poison Creek Trail, but that usage is just, you know, it's wonderful that it's used, but all those conflicts that exist on there that the commuter bicyclists really want to use that quickest point A to point B, and that's typically along these major travel corridors. So we'll evaluate what that potential alternative could be, again, come up with a cost similar to what we're doing for 248, and then decide if we want to put any additional investment in that or decide if there's other opportunities at the state and federal level for funding such a project.
Okay. Alfred, Diane, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Joining me now in the studio, Tom Kelly with U.S. Ski and Snowboard. Good morning, Tom.
Well, good morning, Leslie. I can feel it. It's coming. I know it's coming.
We got cold temperatures at night. That helps.
It does.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the good weekend at Killington. Again, their second year of hosting a women's giant slalom and slalom competition.
Yeah, what an amazing event at Killington, of course, owned and operated by Powder Corp from here in Park City, but just a magnificent weekend, and a lot of folks watched it on NBC on Saturday and Sunday. Michaela Schifrin, second in the giant slalom, a good result for her, but fired her up for the next day. Note that Megan McJames of Park City getting a point scoring finish in 29th in the GS as well, good finish for her. But then the big battle came on Sunday. It was Michaela versus Petra Vlova of Slovakia. Vlova had been the winner in Levy a few weeks ago, so she had the slalom lead. Michaela really wanted to take that, and she got the win, and Petra finishing second. Pretty amazing first run. For those who watched it on NBC, Michaela had this goal that she wanted to be the most dominant skier at the first intermediate on the first run. And boy, she came out of the gate charging, something we had not yet seen in her previous races this season, and a great weekend for her. You know, and overall, what an amazing event at Killington. We had 34,000 spectators there. Our television ratings up 43% on NBC this year. So a lot of interest in the Olympics. And most of all, just taking ski racing back to New England and the heart of our sport. Just really gratifying to see the turnout and all the kids out there, and really hats off to Powder Corp for a great job on that.
Okay, coming up, we've got the women in Lake Louise with the speed events, and pretty good results in training, 5 in the top 20.
Yeah, it was pretty interesting yesterday. You know, a lot of speculation. Where does everybody stand? You know, we've known that Breezy Johnson, a young skier from Jackson, was kind of coming up through the ranks. She had the top time for the USA in the first training run of the season Tuesday up at Lake Louise. She was 7th. Lindsey Vonn in good shape in 8th place. And this is the first year that Lindsey has truly been in top full form going into the season in probably 4 or 5 years. So really anxious to see where she stands. But Stacey Cook was 9th, Jackie Wiles 10th, Michaela Schifrin is going to do both downhills and the Super G 20th. And you can watch all that action live on either NBCSN or Olympic Channel. You can go to USSkiAndSnowboard.com to get the times.
Couple of Americans in the top 20 at the downhill and Super G in Lake Louise this weekend. Ted Ligety, though, not finishing. Is he okay?
Yeah, Ted is fine. You know, we didn't have a lot of success up there in Lake Louise with the men in the downhill on Saturday. Bryce Bennett, a tall, lanky skier from Squaw Valley finishing 21st to lead the USA, and Travis Kanang finishing 16th in the Super G the next day. Ted Ligety going out, but he's fine, and we expect to see him in Beaver Creek this week. So we're all heading to Birds of Prey, a Super G Friday, downhill Saturday, and a giant slalom on Sunday. Ted Ligety going for a 7th career giant slalom win on the Birds of Prey. Stephen Nyman, still a question mark coming back from that injury he suffered last year. He did train up at Lake Louise and then made the decision to not compete. We anticipate that he will train today at Beaver Creek and then make a decision. My guess is that he'll probably wait and maybe look at Val Gardena course, where he's won 3 times, to make his return to action. But it is good to see him back on snow. Again, you'll be able to watch all the action live on NBCSN, NBC, and the Olympic Channel. A lot of coverage, both live streaming on the web and on the mobile apps, and also live on the television on NBCSN and NBC.
Okay, and turning to cross country, what do we got there?
You know, we've never really had tremendous success in the openers, but this was really encouraging this weekend up in Ruka, Finland, a 3-day event. Sadie Bjornsson kicking it off, finishing 2nd at a classic sprint. First time she's actually even made the finals and hasn't qualified out of a heat in a year and a half. Great result for her. She ended up the weekend finishing 11th. Jesse Diggins finishing 12th overall. Keegan Randall 8th fastest in the pursuit freestyle leg. Some good results for the men, too. Erik Bjornsson showing some great diversity. He was in the 20s, but really a pretty good start for him. This weekend, a very, very important event over in Lillehammer. It'll be another classic sprint along with a skiathlon. Both of those will be Olympic qualifying events for our team. Last weekend, both Sadie Bjornsson and Sophie Caldwell clicking off top 8s in that classic sprint, and that will give them the top selection criteria as we look to qualify that team for Pyeongchang.
Okay, and we had a slope style competition.
Yeah, tucked away in a little valley of Stubai, southwest of Innsbruck, a free ski slope style World Cup this weekend. Carolyn Clare finishing 3rd for the women, but big news for Parkites. Local native Colby Stevenson was 3rd in that event. That kind of matches up with the win that he had in Sizeralm, Italy, a year ago. So kind of puts him into the hunt for the Olympic selection. That team for the Olympics will be selected off of the Toyota U.S. Grand Prix and also the Dew Tour. So action there for the slopestyle athletes will begin with the Dew Tour coming up in a couple weeks.
Okay, and then real quick with the jumping in Nordic combined teens.
Yeah, okay results for stars, especially for Brian Fletcher. A couple of top 20s in Nordic combined. The jumper's a little bit back, but Will Rhodes getting 47th to lead the USA there. They're going this weekend. The men's jumpers head to Russia for an event. Women's jumping has its opener. Watch for Sarah Hendrickson and Park City's own Abby Hughes. They'll be jumping in Lillehammer, and you can watch those on the Olympic Channel, both TV and live streaming.
Okay, and we've got some awards happening tonight?
Yeah, we're all kind of fingers crossed right now for our beloved cross-country coach, Matt Whitcomb. He is one of the, I think, 4 finalists for the Team USA Coach of the Year. This is an award that we've won quite a few times over the years. We'll know this evening, that event being held in L.A., and you can watch it on TV coming up on December 23rd.
Okay, Tom, see you next week.
Great. See you next week.
It's Tom Kelly with U.S. Ski and Snowboard. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. The Summit County Arts Council gearing up for the 2017 version of Branded PC. It opens Saturday. In the studio with details, I have Jocelyn Scudder, the Arts Council Community Manager. She's also the Chief Content and Brand Relationship Manager for this event. Good morning, Jocelyn.
Good morning.
So tell us what Branded PC is.
So Branded PC is a pop-up showroom and retail shop, and it's celebrating our local creative makers. It's produced and led by us, the Park City Summit County Arts Council. And so we are an umbrella nonprofit with the mission to promote, support, and strengthen arts and culture in our community. And so the goal with this project is to help really expand the arts and culture conversation to include our local creative entrepreneurs and makers.
Okay. So it's happening when and where?
Yeah. So it's happening. Our launch is this Saturday, December 2nd, and the public launch party will be from 7:30 till 9. And then it's a retail shop and pop-up shop. So it'll be open actually the whole week after. It's an 8-day event. We'll have a soft opening on Sunday the 3rd. We'll probably be cleaning up from our celebrations from the party. And then the official pop-up hours are December 4th through December 10th. And this will be held at the Kimball Art Center, 1401 Kearns Boulevard.
So just regular business hours then for them?
Regular business hours, except a little bit extended. So Monday through Friday, that's, December 4th through the 8th, will be 10 a.m. to 7 p.m., so a little bit longer. So if people are working, they can come after work. And then on Saturday and Sunday, the 9th and 10th, that'll be from regular business hours, 12 to 5.
Okay. And what are we going to find there?
So, Branded PC is designed to showcase all of our local creative industries and brands, but most importantly, the people that are behind these brands. So it's a really kind of interesting and unique way to retail, you know, something creatively. We have all these really innovative and amazing people in our community who have really, it's taken guts to produce these really amazing products. And so we are going to be showcasing them. And it's kind of a magazine meets retail shop. So we have over 43 brands that will be represented in this retail shop. So it's a great time to come out, shop local for Christmas time. And it's also, there's a huge storytelling element to this show. So we're, you know, really bringing out the narrative of each maker, what inspires them, what has really gotten them through and help them create, these amazing products that'll be highlighted in the retail show.
Right. So is it all part of the Kimball art exhibit ongoing, or are you just taking over the Kimball? Or?
We are taking over the main gallery space. Kimball Art Center has generously donated their main gallery. So they are our hosting sponsor. And, we're just thrilled that they've done that because they're really looking at that as a connection. You know, they host a lot of makers in their space. And so it's great that they've supported us with this mission as well. And it's a great centralized, beautiful, beautiful space to have their retail pop-up shop.
Okay. And then they'll have just maybe an exhibit downstairs?
This will be the main exhibit
Okay.
Within all of the Kimball Art Center, the 2nd through the 10th. And then they do have, I think it's David Habnick coming in after that.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
Well, I do want to just shout out to our sponsors. We were had such good fortune to have brought on some amazing sponsors. So we have Alpha Graphics generously donating some printing for us to tell the storytelling elements, which is such a huge part of this pop-up. We have Farasha, Lumi, Poison Creek Furniture and Design, Renovate Park City, Spedco, all are producing sponsors. And then we also have food and beverage sponsors, so it's going to be a great party. We have Beehive Distilling coming on board, Park City Brewery, Old Town Cellars, Joffles, Cafe Trio, Boneyard, Twisted Fern, all taking part in our party. So it's going to be a blast.
Okay. Jocelyn, thanks.
Thanks so much.
Jocelyn Scudders with the Summit County Arts Council. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW.